Welcome to Built to Play, Games Technology for the Arts Inclined. I'm Armin Iqbali.
And I'm Daniel Rosen. This week, we ponder the nature of egovania.
Plus, we find out what it means to win and hear about some sore losers.
But first, a video game confessional wants to show us how the other side lives. In 2010, David Olinsky reviewed The Kind of Game You Don't Really Hear About, a hidden object game.
Specifically, one themed around a TV show that hadn't been on air for about 20 years, Murder, She Wrote.
Hidden object games don't have explosions or stories or complicated mechanics. They're like digital Where's Waldo. You explore a scenery until you find the person or object you're looking for.
Games like this don't get reviewed, or at least not by popular critics.
But David was a games writer at the AV Club, and Murder, She Wrote was still a video game.
To him, it deserved the same level of scrutiny any other game that landed on his desk. Not long after, he took a trip to the Games Developer Conference. Think of it as a big meeting place for game designers, where they'd go to talk about lessons learned and big ideas.
It was his first trip to GDC, and so he wanted a hook to introduce himself. So he went with...
I'm David from the AV Club. I just had a review go up this week on Murder, She Wrote, and just conversation would naturally get sparked from there, where sort of they exhibited an attitude that was dismissive or surprised that A, I would be reviewing such a game, and B, that I would be taking it seriously as if there was something else I should have been doing.
The snickering was a little indicative of how narrowly people define games and continue to do so.
You'll often hear exclusives like, they're casual games, or they're not for real gamers.
And then there's all the harassment women involved in the industry face online.
That all came to a head in summer 2014, when the dreaded G word reared its ugly head.
The Wikipedia definition is just, the Gamergate controversy concerned sexism in video game culture. It garnered significant public attention after August 2014, when several women within the video game industry, including game developers Zoe Quinn and Brianna Wu and feminist cultural critic Anita Sarkeesian, were subjected to a sustained campaign of misogynistic attacks. The campaign was coordinated in the online forums of Reddit, 4chan, and 8chan in an anonymous and amorphous movement that ultimately came to be represented by the Twitter hashtag Gamergate.
And if you were a woman in the industry or someone supporting them, you had your lives threatened or personal information threatened to be released online. Not much has changed since then.
I did a review on Sunset Overdrive. And just sort of, I talked about how, you know, this is a game that claims punk rock as its inspiration, and yet at the same time is adhering to just tropes and cliches and sort of can only make sense of things outside of games as a game. And that was a review that I mentioned Anita Sarkeesian earlier. She tweeted that out as just a piece of writing she was praising. And I've been writing about games for a long, long time. But to have that review called out and to sort of be along on a 24-hour period of her being threatened, jokingly or otherwise, about her understanding of punk, and just people's vitriolic responses to something she didn't even do, just something she was putting out there, thinking and talking with friends about, like, well, what was my intent behind that review? What was I trying to do? What was I saying? Just sort of stewing on that for a couple of months. And sort of when I came up for air, what I had hit on was just... I think it's just time to hear from people who aren't writers.
So that's what prompted David to start his own project, to keep track of the online grievances between players and creators.
It's called Don't Die. Every week, David releases two interviews on his website. One interview of a player, one interview of a creator. They sound a little like this one with Jen Dalk.
I used to have an OkCupid profile, and I put on there that I'm a gamer. But the first question guys would ask me was, what kind of games do you play? And I'm like, oh, I've played Borderlands and RPGs and, you know, Halo and, you know, games on my iPad and stuff like that. And in Skyrim and, you know, just like, I have to search for game names that might be impressive. Because if I don't play the right kind of games, then I'm not a true gamer.
Oh, f*** that.
Yeah. And there was a time that all I did was play iPad games. Like, I would come home, and I would reach for my iPad, And I would sit there and catch up on all the games that have, like, the daily rewards and stuff. And it would keep me busy for, you know, a while. Then my day is shot. But I was playing. You know, it was something to play. And I consider myself a gamer, even though I was only doing that. But if I talk to anyone else, they're like, that's not being a gamer. I feel like when someone says I'm a gamer, they mean I play shooters. And anything else isn't gaming. It's casual gaming.
I'm trying to remember her conversation specifically. She's, I think, 26, lives on the East Coast. Mainly what strikes me about that conversation is an empathy deficit in games, which can be interpreted in many ways. Some of it's like the tone deafness we can have for each other online, where a lot of those threats we spoke about earlier, I think people are not necessarily thinking through the fact that there are, you know, humans behind these avatars online. But she spoke about this empathy deficit in another way, which is that, you know, she would love to play games like Destiny if only games like Destiny were designed from the mindset that Destiny may be someone's very first shooter. And that's kind of problematic of, I think, a lot of bigger games now, which is they're built on that assumption that you grew up playing Mario or Zelda or all those other series. Like, you understand, you know, how to operate an 8-button controller from the outset. And, I mean, I just sort of remember her being really frustrated at, like, trying to get into these games. I think literally the quote from her is, like, literally, games keep putting mountains in front of me.
What makes this all harder is that the focus on traditional blockbusters cuts both ways.
To make a title with that big a budget costs millions of dollars and needs a high return. It's risky. One big failure and the developer could fall apart.
Consider Assassin's Creed Unity. That game took 10 studios to make over 5 years, which implies a few hundred people worked on it.
It's also around the 7th game in that series, and it hasn't changed all that much since the first one.
Why? Well, the first few sold really well, and people liked the series. Why should Ubisoft make a big bet on a new franchise when Unity, combined with another sequel, sold about 10 million copies?
As a player, that can get kind of stale, but imagine being on the developer side.
The people who make Assassin's Creed keep making Assassin's Creed.
And even if you're not in the main studio, chances are you're one of the 10 who are working on it anyway. This isn't true of just that series either. If you work on any big budget title, the process is similar.
And it can drain on you. You don't even have to be in the trenches to feel it.
Greg Zeschuk founded BioWare. For a while, he was the general manager of BioWare Austin.
He helped make Dragon Age and Mass Effect, two really popular series.
But in 2012, he retired.
There's kind of two main parts to it. One was I just sort of felt my passion had waned, and I'm a very kind of passion-driven person. I like to be, you know, super engaged in what I'm doing. So, and what I didn't realize, perhaps, that at that point I was quite burnt out. And, you know, like, and it took me probably about a year to go, oh, yeah, you know, I was really burnt out last year. Because you don't see it in yourself, but I'm like, holy cow. And you know, it's really funny because I look back at some of these photos of myself when I'm, like, right at the pinnacle of releasing Star Wars and all this stuff. And I'm like, I think I weigh, like, 45 pounds more than I do now. And I'm all doughy and pasty. And I'm like, oh, my God, I look terrible. And a lot of that's just the stress, the pressure. You know, that's the physical manifestation. And then the psychological manifestation is simply, you know, lack of desire to continue that. The other bucket was, on a personal level, I just had really felt I'd accomplished everything I wanted to accomplish. Like, we've been doing it a long time. The idea of BioWare, what we were doing, was probably more than 20 years, probably 22 years or something. And you know, we'd accomplished a lot. We'd worked with a lot of fabulous people over the years. And it was sort of like, well, I'd done everything I wanted to do in it. Like, I could continue doing it, but I didn't have to.
He didn't seem at all burnt out to me. Like, he was in good spirits. And he's also, like, I hear this too about a lot of people who quit games and do something else, is that they're way, way happier now. I don't know how much of that necessarily has to do with games. I think some of it has to do with your own predisposition. I think some of it has to do with, like, how much experience outside of games are you bringing to your games. And with him, I think just, we talked a little bit about that. Like, you know, you made a lot of very big, influential, you know, acclaimed games, and you're sort of done with them as a player. And I think that some of that has to do with sort of what I would characterize as just a lack of creativity in games overall. Like, I think it's odd, and I didn't ask Greg, you know, like, with all the bargaining power and goodwill he had built up, you know, would you want to do something different and unlike other games before? He sort of just chose to cash out, and I'm not saying he sold out, just like he was done. I do think if the mindset was less risk averse, there's another interview I have coming up with Lauren Lanning, who has worked on the Oddworld games, and he says, like, something tangible that has changed in the game space, typically, you know, it's referred to as AAA or the big budget games, is that many of those studios used to devote dollars to R&D, and that doesn't really happen as much anymore. And that's just hearsay. I don't have figures that can confirm or deny that. But, you know, if someone who's worked in games for a long time at that level is telling me that, I would believe that's true, because that's not really something you can read about when you're just seeing games written about as reviews or previews. You know, that's sort of a behind-the-curtains peek into why things are so samey. And I think if that was less the case, like, I do sort of maybe childishly believe that there would be maybe less burnout, maybe more creativity, maybe more the feeling of more possibilities.
Who is the industry losing by kind of being stuck in this current rut?
I think it's not losing anyone. I think it's turning off potential people who would want to be curious and involved. Like, on the internet, like, a lot of this stuff seems to loom so large because you go to the same sites as other people, you follow the same people, they talk about the same things that you talk about. But in reality, like, most people have never heard of Gamergate. In reality, most people don't know about the delineation between AAA and indie games. Our parents couldn't tell you even what BioWare is. I think, like, the true thing, and one of my original misconceptions was, you know, when I sent that first tweet out, I asked people, like, hey, have you stopped playing games? And another woman I interviewed for the site, Shauna Rosenberg, she sent an email to me, again, another 8-10 paragraph email saying at the very bottom, like, but I don't think I fit your profile because I never really stopped playing games. And I thought about it, and it's totally true. Like, people don't stop playing. You just sort of take breaks, or you're waiting for a thing to spark your interest again. I don't think the threat is necessarily losing people as consumers. I think where people will be lost now is in the workforce. Larlyn McWilliams told me, like, in the last 8-9 months since Gamergate, like, she's heard more women talk about leaving than in the course of her entire career, which dates back at least to the 90s. So, you know, it really sucks, and it's ugly, and a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with games is increasingly becoming central to what games are or aren't, whereas I think the only thing that games are or aren't is fun.
As he mentioned a second ago, David interviewed Shauna Rosenberg, who's a 42-year-old librarian from Ohio. She grew up playing multi-user dungeons, or MUDs for short. They're the kind of game that don't really exist anymore, but you can think of it as a multiplayer text adventure. Not many people played MUDs even back then, so it was always exciting when they found someone new.
If you got someone involved with a MUD and they became addicted, that was like a soul point. Like, or if you got someone into $5,000 of debt, you gained a soul point. And it's like, I just want everybody that can't get some enjoyment out of games or some kind of emotional impact, I want them to be involved. Like, I don't care if they do have Sonic porn on their first try. Like, yeah. As long as they're not, you know, being awful, then they're my people. Like, you're all my people.
David Walensky is a freelance games writer based in the United States. His website is Don't Die, which you can find at nodontdie.com. All the clips you heard were edited down from fairly long interviews on his site, so if you liked the taste you got here, be sure to check it out. Special thanks to Jen Dalk, Greg Zeschuk, and Shauna Rosenberg for letting us play the audio. So while we're looking at the big budget games, there's also the kind of prevalence of the same games that we're all looking forward to over and over again, even among the indie ones, and that's kind of centered around Koji Igarashi this time, who is making what?
He's making a game called Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night, which is essentially a spiritual successor to Igarashi's work on the Castlevania series. Igarashi left Konami a couple years ago after having not really made a Castlevania in a long time. In fact, Igarashi started work on the series in 1997 with Symphony of the Night and ended it in 2008 with his work on Castlevania Order of Ecclesia.
Well, I mean, did Symphony of the Night come out in 1997, or is that when he started working on
it? I think that's when he started working on it. I think the game came out in 98, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, like, you call this kind of genre what?
So most people call the genre Metroidvanias, owing to many of the games in the genre aping design quirks from Nintendo's Metroid games and, obviously, the Castlevania series. Basically, they have a world you can explore that's not quite open. All the doors are visible to you, though, and you just don't have the tools to open the doors. It's like keys and locks, but the key is the ability to turn into a bat to get over a ledge.
Yeah, and then you'd level up often throughout these games, and you gain on top of that stuff, and you kind of gain new cooler
weapons. They have some RPG mechanics, they have some platforming mechanics. It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Okay, so It's an interesting premise, and we haven't quite seen games like this. I mean, there's been Axiom Verge recently.
There have been a couple indie games like this. I mean, Rogue Legacy is a lot like this.
That's true.
I mean, Axiom Verge, as you mentioned. Mark of the Ninja is a little bit like this. They're separate into individual levels.
Yeah, and there's also any game that kind of really pulls from the sealing off areas by way of abilities is taking some inspiration from these series.
The genre is not dead, but Castlevania was definitely what popularized it.
They haven't made that specifically a Castlevania game in a while.
Especially because they used to make them like once a year on the DS. There were like four of those.
And apparently they weren't bad.
No, I mean, some of them were better than others. Dawn of Sorrow is sort of a disaster.
What was the Order of Ecclesia? Any better?
Order of Ecclesia is super good. Order of Ecclesia is actually like a weird pseudo sequel to Castlevania 2, in that it's sort of got towns and a world you're traversing. Order of Ecclesia is really good. It was a good swan song. Unlike the other game Igarashi worked on that actually killed the series, Castlevania Judgment, the fighting game with designs from the Death Note people.
Nice. Well, but so long as we're talking about changing gears, though, the thing with Bloodstain is that it is a little devious what this Kickstarter is doing, what the money he's raising.
So Igarashi has stated in multiple interviews about the game with Gamasutra, GameSpot, and US Gamer that initial 500,000 Kickstarter goal is 10% of the game's budget.
Okay, so that means it's the budget is roughly about 50 grand?
Yeah. Well, no, it's about 5 million.
5 million grand?
5 million grand?
It's 5 million.
5 million thousand.
Yeah. Grand has got to be in there somewhere. Anyway,
Ulysses S. Grant. He's publishing the game.
It's
the game itself is buried in Grant's tomb.
It's 5S million. So that's a reasonable budget for this kind of game, especially considering, like, look at if you can see that concert art, like, that looks like pretty highly detailed. It looks like you're going to have to put a lot of time and effort into building those levels.
$5 million is a relatively reasonable sum for a game, especially a smaller one. And to be fair, most Kickstarters that we've seen lately kind of work like that, especially the ones from major developers like Igarashi or like Mighty No. 9. The Kickstarter goal, reaching it or reaching a certain amount of backers, is simply a stipulation from the investor saying we will kick in X amount of dollars when you meet Y amount of backers. That other 90%, of course, comes from those investors. Igarashi just sort of needs to prove that people still want a Castlevania-style game from him, or as he calls it, an Igavania, which is really what he calls it.
I mean, why would he call it that? I mean,
legal reasons a little bit, but
I think one, because he doesn't want to mention Metroid.
Yeah, he says he wasn't inspired by Metroid when he made Symphony of the Night.
Which, I mean, I think it's fair to still say that it came from those two games, but I get why he wouldn't want to say Metroid, and I get why he can't say Castlevania.
I can understand why he doesn't say Symphony of the Night isn't a Metroidvania, because it wasn't inspired by Metroid, but every other game was inspired by it or Metroid or Castlevania, and thus they are probably Metroidvanias. Like, maybe Symphony of the Night isn't, but
yeah, I mean, like, whatever. You can ascribe, just because it was the first one to do that kind of thing, like, just because Casablanca perfected the three-act structure doesn't mean it wasn't influenced by anything.
We don't call every movie a Casablancan.
Exactly.
A Casablancavania?
Yeah. But, I mean, Terrible name for game genres aside.
Yeah.
This is
There's been a lot of hubbub about how the Kickstarter is sending a message to the now floundering Konami, as we discussed the last couple episodes, that this is something they should have been jumping all over. And I don't think it is.
No, not really. I mean, one, this fits into a trend of something that we've seen a lot of, meaning that high-class game designers get a lot of money because they are well-known and they make something people love. This is no indication that this is a revitalization of a franchise. No one yet is clamoring. Saying that you want Bloodstained might mean you want another one of those Castlevania games, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you want another five, which is what Konami would be interested in.
Right, and also it doesn't say that you would want a Castlevania game that would cost, you know, X tens of millions to make and will sell 6 million copies.
Right.
Bloodstained will sell 1 million, 2 million copies, maybe?
Hopefully. I mean, what this basically is especially as it goes past its stretch goals, is a pre-order system.
It's like a marketing campaign.
Yeah.
It's a really smart marketing campaign, but it's a marketing campaign. Yeah. And I mean, Konami also has just announced today that they are all in on mobile now, so they never were going to be interested in this anyway. It's not going to make the kind of rewards they need.
Yeah.
But the really crazy thing about the stretch goals, and it might be the most devious marketing Kickstarter I've ever seen, is that the more stretch goals unlock, not the more you put in money, the more people, like, tweet about the game, or the more people draw fan art of the game.
Or the more pictures you take at castles?
Sure.
That's also a thing in there, which is crazy.
I mean, we're in an advantage because there is a castle in this city.
Yeah. Yeah. Casa Loma, invented by local crazy man.
What's really fascinating to me is that it's paralleling really well with the other revival Kickstarter going on.
Which is the same premise, in the sense that it's like, it's an old game made by these guys who used to make that game you love.
Right, it's a ukulele be made by former developers of Banjo-Kazooie from Rare.
Exactly. And if you like collecting stuff, if you liked walking across this environment,
it's almost a certain bet that they also have investors, but they haven't mentioned it anywhere. And that Kickstarter is a lot less devious from a marketing perspective.
Yeah.
Though they did release concept art recently of one of the characters in the game being a literal snake wearing literal trousers.
Well, I mean, like, he's not really wearing those trousers. He doesn't, like, his legs, he doesn't even go all the way down into them. He just kind of, like, the trousers are where he balances in.
Yeah.
Which I... All right, I'm not going to complain about dumb design rage people.
I mean, and on this note, Mighty No. 9 was pretty clearly a marketing ploy from the start. Like, we all kind of realized that.
Yeah, it's got investors now.
Inafune's got investors. It's got a lot more now. But that game's only gotten bigger and bigger, all without even coming out, which is probably a bad thing for them. But we'll see.
Yeah.
None of that though is bad. Like, making the game that you used to make, like, now you have, you know, there's a safety net now. Like, you don't have to go to the publisher because the publisher doesn't want it. Well, you can go right to the fans and show that there's the interest and then get the investors involved. You know, that's what people want, apparently.
Yeah. What he's done here, though, is that one of the stipulations in the contract was, like, you will get this X amount of money.
Yeah.
But assuming you get X amount of money from fans.
Right.
Like, as soon as they did this with the Veronica Mars movie and the Zach Braff movie, right?
Exactly.
It was like, hey, yeah, sure. I mean, look, we'd love to make another Veronica Mars movie, but if you can prove that anyone will see it, let them put down their dollars.
Exactly. But, you know, like, it's letting these niche works thrive in an environment where companies that would once publish them are either over-specializing or not out of the business, like Konami. But my issue is different. Like, is Kickstarter just becoming a place for developers who are, you know, away from their old series to just sort of do it again?
Yeah, I mean,
is that what's happening here? Because, like, I mean, that's not what it used to be to a certain extent.
And none of these games are particularly interesting.
Like, no.
Cool, you get to make your new Mega Man. Cool.
Exactly. We have a really good old-style... Like, Mega Man 9 and 10 were a really good old-style Mega Man. And yes, I can understand having the itch for a new one, but, like...
Are you really going to change things? Like, is this actually going to be...
Yeah, is it going to be something new? Is it going to be a step forward? Same with Bloodstained. Same with Ukulele. Same with... what else? There's another one, isn't there? It's Pillars of Eternity, which is Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, Pillars of Eternity, Baldur's Gate. To be fair to them, I don't think they really had all that much outside investment. But Pillars of Eternity. But no, that was just like, hey, did you like this kind of game that we once made? We can make it again.
And to be fair to, like, Double Fine Adventure, Double Fine Adventure was different. Yeah. Broken Age was a little different. But it was the same idea. We used to make adventure games. Would you like an adventure game?
Yeah, and one thing...
Banner Saga was different.
Banner Saga was different. FTL was different.
FTL was very different.
And that was actually around the same time as Broken Age.
Yeah.
The, like... The thing with Kickstarter is that the promise is kind of there that, hey, look, we're supposed to be getting this interesting talent and showing the kind of game we want. What this is really showing is that we just want the same things over and over again.
What we're kind of proving to the publishers is that they're right.
They're right. They
that
should
we
just
will
be
just
making
keep
the
buying
same...
sequels.
Yeah.
They should just be making sequels to what we want them to make sequels to.
Yeah. Or like... To some extent, Broken Age manages to go... Like, it's not really a traditional old-style adventure game. It takes a lot of those tropes, but it doesn't, like, actually go all the way back to how crazy those are. Mighty No. 9, though, and Yooka-Laylee look to be exactly like those things.
Identical to those old games. Does it end anywhere? Kojima kickstart a Metal Gear Solid game? No. No. I don't think there's any amount of... We will give you your $100 million.
If
you can get... A million.
Yeah, it would. I think he would have to kickstart him a starting price of like at least $2 million.
You have to kickstart Kojima.
You have to kickstart.
Here's what we're doing. We are kickstarting a new Hideo Kojima.
Yeah, my name is Phil. I want to be the new Hideo Kojima. I'm going to start from there.
You start at $5. I will call you and just say the words transferring. At $10, I will send you.
By $10, I will keep calling you and keep saying
transferring until you transfer.
At $20, I will transfer.
At $20, I will transfer my soul into a PSP. At $25, I will beg you, please free my soul from this eternal plastic coffin.
Have you seen any interesting Kickstarter games recently?
Not recently. It's been sort of a dearth of stuff. It's been a lot of like, hey, did you like this game? We'll make this game.
I mean, there was that guy who's making a new Toe Jam and Earl. Toe Jam and Earl.
Exactly.
I
know Kickstarter has always sort of been a marketing thing to a certain extent.
Oh, totally. Like, I'm not disappointed in this for being a marketing ploy. Yeah. They've always been a marketing ploy to some extent. The thing I'm disappointed in is that it's just kind of showing that we have no taste as a society.
We just sort of want the same things again and again. It's like, I would be interested if Bloodstained... Because here's the thing. Those later DS Castlevanias, like Ord of Ecclesia, Portrait of Ruin, and Dawn of Sorrow, are all pretty different from one another. And if Bloodstained's as different from those games... But Bloodstained has to be as different from those games as they were from the pre-Symphony of the Night Castlevanias to be really interesting. Like, it's got to be a totally fresh take on that idea.
Yeah, and otherwise it's just... I don't know, when you have all these players banking money, how different do you want to make it, right? Do you want to be scared that your fan base won't come back, or your fan base who has put in money now and has a vested interest in this thing coming out is going to be angry at you because you changed something?
Yeah.
I mean, now you have the hardcore fans. You have the people who thought, like, Ord of Ecclesia was the bomb. Mm-hmm. That, like, what are you going to do with... How far away are you allowed to take this game before it just becomes not what they paid for?
Peter Lisinski used to play baseball in his hometown of Oakville, and he loved it.
And he had started playing when he was pretty young, about 6 or 7 years old. His teams weren't always great, but that's not why he was there. He just really enjoyed playing baseball.
By university, he'd aged out of his house league. He'd never won a championship. Instead, he was an umpire for a year.
And that might have been his last year in that league, had they not opened that new age bracket.
The new bracket gave him one more summer to play. More than that, it gave him a chance to visit his family. He'd been living in Toronto for school, and this gave him a reason to head back to Oakville at least once a week.
So he joined, and that year, his team made it to the championship round.
And they were losing, for a while anyway. They'd started the final inning down 5 or 6 runs.
We'd been losing, and so I'd never won a championship before. We were losing, but we were coming back. We were on our way to win. There was, however, a curfew in the rules. The game had to stop by a certain time on the clock, and if you didn't finish the inning you were in, you had to go back to the score of the previous inning. The previous inning we were down by a lot. This inning we were coming back. We were starting to get very excited. I mean, we weren't ready to say, oh, we're definitely going to win this, but we definitely thought we had a good chance. Especially when I've never been the best baseball player ever. I was hitting near the bottom of the order when the entire bottom of the order got on base and batted in runs, and it was time for our really good hitters to come up. And their pitching was struggling. It started to go well then.
Peter stood on third base, his eyes on home. They were only down by a couple runs, so if they hit a big one, they'd win.
But then the game paused.
And the other team's coach wanders onto the field.
The coach comes out to talk to the umpire about a call from earlier again. The pitcher calls the coach out to the mound once or twice. Players keep stopping to tie their shoes.
And what is the thought running through your mind at that point?
It's like, really, let's get on with it. And I think some of the parents are starting to yell, get on with it, let's go. I mean, the coach does have a reputation. He's been tossed in the past for arguing with the umps too much. And I, at the time, I was also working as an umpire. I could have, my brain was like, if I was them, I would, if I was the ump, I would toss this guy. But again, it's a little biased.
Were you given any opportunity to run for home?
I think the game is called with me on third base.
Losing that way sucked, and for Peter, it ruined the end of the season.
I was pretty mad. I was really mad at that guy. I thought he was being a poor sport.
He wrote the coach an email saying as much, and the coach later apologized.
Still, when you pause a game like that, it feels so childish.
Plus, it was a house league game. People weren't really there to make a name for themselves.
But we do have a name for these kinds of people.
Sore losers, which is what our next story is all about.
Tom Murphy VII ran into a much weirder kind of sore loser in 2012, although it wasn't an argumentative coach or a shoe-tying player.
My original thought was to do something about taking a Nintendo game and playing it perfectly. There's this thing of tool-assisted speedruns where people will single-step through the frames of a game using an emulator, and they'll try to press the buttons at exactly the right moment to have like the best possible score. And I wanted to take some very small segment of a game. I was thinking like Karate Kid. It's this terrible Nintendo game that I played a lot when I was a kid. And I wanted to just like make the very best possible by computer, like 5 seconds of gameplay. Optimal Karate Kid. So that was my initial approach. And I realized that as I was doing that, I needed to figure out like, when I'm trying to play karate, what's better? You know, like, how do I know whether I'm making progress or not? And I came across this sort of general idea of progress in at least old Nintendo games, which is these lexicographic orderings. I thought, wow, that really would apply to a lot of games, not just Karate Kid. And so then I sort of changed my idea and worked on that instead. I'm trying to make something that was really general that could play a lot of different games without tuning. And I don't know, there's just something about, I played these games as a kid, and they kind of, some of them kind of vexed me. And I like bringing my, you know, 35-year-old self to those games and what I've learned since then, having to do with computers, and kind of like mastering them with, I haven't gotten really better at video games, but I have gotten a lot better at computer programming. And so I like the idea of being in control of those games that haunted me a little bit as a kid.
He ended up building it in two parts, Learn Fun and Play Fun. Learn Fun would watch him play the game,
and Play Fun would try to replicate it. Tom would leave Play Fun overnight, and the next morning, check in on how far it got into a game.
And so what the lexicographic ordering is basically you have like, actually Mario Brothers has a very simple instance of this, which is if you get coins, that's usually good, right? Getting coins is better. Your number of coins goes up, but when you get 100 coins, it goes back to zero coins, but you get an extra life, right? And so your coins doesn't always go up as you're doing well in this game, because right at the moment you get your 100th coin, it goes back to zero. But if you think about your coins and your lives sort of together, and you say, lives are bigger than coins, but coins are progress, that pair together is called a lexicographic ordering, which is that it's going up, the pair together is going up, as long as either coins are going up or lives are going up, and then coins can go back down to zero. And so there's a lot of things in Super Mario Brothers like that, like the world 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, 1-4, and then 2-1, same kind of thing. Or your position on the screen, your X coordinate on the screen, or your score, which is the multiple digits of the score. And so that I thought was like, in some ways, Mario, I mean, it was a really influential game. A lot of games followed the kinds of principles that are in it. It fired on all cylinders there. It was a game that I knew well. It's fun to watch. Everyone knows it. And it fit this model, this idea that I had.
Did it manage to optimize Mario? Is it? Can you get a perfect run out of?
No, it's nowhere near that. So when I don't know why I thought I could actually optimize it. Sometimes I just have ideas and I work on them for a while. And in retrospect, it was like not a good idea. Every frame, so there's 60 frames a second on a Nintendo. And in every frame, you could press 256 different button combinations. There's 8 buttons and you could press any subset of them. And so like after 1 second of gameplay, that's 256 times 256 times 256, 60 times, it's already way bigger than like the number of atoms in the universe. There's no way you could actually try all of the different button sequences in a Nintendo game. I don't know why I thought you could do that. So really all it does in Mario is plays the game pretty well. And it gets much farther than I did, which is pretty cool.
Tom began to record his software playing these games and posted them online. But as he watched Playfon work its way through Super Mario Bros., he noticed something weird.
Got those coins, and no problem with this part anymore. Mario can see, and what was that? That was actually Mario exploiting a bug in the game, whereby you can stomp Goombas from the bottom, or other monsters.
When it does things that I certainly didn't do in my playthrough, and I didn't even know about, that feels, it's not really intelligence, but it feels like intelligence, and it's definitely really fun to watch.
So he tried applying it to other Nintendo games and recorded what happened.
Here, he found a few guidelines for when they would work and when they would run in circles. In a game like Zelda, they have no idea what to do. The world's too open-ended. Same issue with Pac-Man.
But in Russian Attack or Contra, or most games where you move to the right, they aren't half bad.
Now watch him stab these guys. You don't even see the knife, it comes out so fast.
Then there's the third category, games that require strategy. There, it usually fails, but in a way that's totally fascinating.
Take Tetris, for example. LearnFun and PlayFun don't realize that they need to clear rows of blocks. Instead, it just stacks blocks on top of each other.
And let's fast forward a bit to see how this all ends. It's not good. So now, it's almost done, and
it's like right about to lose. Like, the next piece, as soon as it spawns and it lands, it's going to end the game. So it pauses the game. It just presses start, the game says pause, and it just sits there in forever, like hours. Because as soon as it unpauses, it's going to lose, and it doesn't want to lose. So it figures it can continue forever indefinitely just sitting there waiting. That, like, gave me goosebumps when I saw that happen. It's almost scary. I mean, to see Mario jumping backwards or jumping off the middle of a wall or stomping a Goomba from the bottom is just, like, the kind of thing you sort of expect from a computer playing a game. It's funny. This was not, I mean, I expected it to play the game and be bad at it or be good at it, but pausing is somehow a little bit outside the game itself, right? Like, you imagine it putting down the controller and kind of looking you in the eye and saying, like, how about we just don't do this anymore? I know that's not really what's happening, but it struck me as clever beyond what I was even considering as clever play.
And this isn't the only time they try something like this. My favorite example is when they try to play ice hockey.
So it's a USA versus Sweden, I think. And the game goes pretty well at the beginning. It's like scoring goals on Sweden. It's playing as USA. It's what it chooses. In the second period, it flips the two goals, just like in real hockey. And then it's still kind of trying to score goals in the right goal, which is now its own goal. And so it gets hilariously lopsided where the score is like 20-something to 6 or something like that. So it's starting to look really hopeless. But then there's like a face-off, and it decides, like, I'm not going to take this face-off. And it just sits there for minutes waiting for Sweden to take the move. And I guess there's some balancing in that game where the computer opponent won't actually take the face-off if you're winning it. Like, it's like, hey, you can have this. So it just kind of sits there stalling. And then another face-off happens where one of the players somehow doesn't come back to the face-off. And this one, I actually don't think anyone knows about this bug in ice hockey. And that causes the game to go on indefinitely again, which I'm not sure if that was lucky or if it specifically chose that outcome. But it was, that's pretty funny to me. So the game, I can run it in an emulator and see if I take control myself at that moment, there's no way to get the guy to come back to the game. Like, it's just stuck there forever.
So it's just permanently glitched, that match.
Yep, permanently glitched.
Coming back to that video and seeing that the game has somehow managed to defeat itself. Mm-hmm. What is your reaction at that moment?
I mean, I think I guess I like that because currently I don't think it's going to win any games. Maybe pinball. Like, it's smart enough to probably just play pinball forever. I don't think that game ever ends. So the most delightful thing it can do is unexpected things. It can break the game. It can figure out ways to defeat situations, bosses, or whatever that I didn't expect. And glitches are really fun. I think speedrunners love to find them and abuse them. And as a computer programmer, like, I like, and video game enthusiast, I love to see how the programmer got it wrong and how that leads to amusement.
I think, okay, so we can both agree, I think, that in the case of Tetris and ice hockey, it didn't lose. Mm-hmm. It didn't play very well, but has it won? Did it win those games, would you say?
I don't think it, well, I wouldn't say that it's won. I think you could probably make an argument in like a court of law by some technicality that you could argue that it hasn't lost, and maybe by some technicality that counts as winning. But these games have like win screens. You know when you've won Tetris because there's some rocket that blasts off, or hockey, it actually tells you you won. And that didn't happen. So I don't think I could claim that it's won.
Greetings, Professor Falcon.
So like when Whopper in War Games says,
"Strange game. The only winning move is not to play."
He's not saying the only way to not lose is to not play. He actually considers it winning to decide that the game is futile.
How about a nice game of chess?
But the fact of the matter is, you can win Tetris. If you're good enough, you can win it. So in that case, it might not be like nuclear war.
Tom now works for Google, but he's pretty far away from teaching a program to lose gracefully.
But Learn Fun and Play Fun maybe aren't quite the sore losers they appear to be. Has there ever been a moment in your life where you wish that last hockey player just wouldn't show up? You could kind of break the world's scripting somehow?
I'm pretty sure that when I'm on my deathbed, I will feel that way. You know what I mean? What PlayFun is actually doing when it's paused there is continuously trying out different button sequences right at the moment of its death. It's saying, okay, what if I unpause and then press left and then A for a little bit and so on? And each time it sees that it dies, right? So it always decides to just keep the game paused. So it is thinking. It's thinking and finding out that it's hopeless. I hope if I could pause right before dying and I could just think about, hopefully not just what will happen when I die, because that sounds terrifying, but just any thought, that would be pretty good. I would be okay with that.
Tom Murphy VII, or Tom 7, is a programmer at Google.
You can find all his work and his videos on Learn Fun and Play Fun at tom7.org.
We'll have a link in our show notes.
Special thanks to the editor of the Cold Lake Sun, Peter Lozinski. He's a good friend of mine, and he helped lend that opening story. This last story of this episode is about a win,
although it does involve quite a bit of loss.
This segment can get pretty grim. If you have any kids in the room, I highly recommend they leave. There is some discussion of trauma.
I have always had a problem with addictive tendencies. Even like as a child, I liked like sugary foods too much and clearly was like very addicted to them. So I've always had addiction problems. But I started drinking when I was about 20. And immediately was out of control with it. Like, immediately my relationship with alcohol was a bad one.
You're hearing Kiva Smith Pearson. She's a cartoonist based in Portland.
Alcohol was self-medication quite a lot. I'm bipolar. It would bring me down when I was feeling too manic, and it would perk me up if I was feeling too depressed.
For those who have never experienced what bipolar disorder is, could you give an explanation for how that feels?
Yeah. How do I describe how it feels to be bipolar? It doesn't feel like super different. I hope. I don't know. I've been bipolar my whole life, so I'm guessing here. I think it's just that sometimes your feelings become so extreme and are so outside of your control. Your mood swings become exhausting. My bipolar disorder affects my sleep really badly. So, well, before I started medication, when I was in an upswing mode, I wouldn't get more than like 2 hours sleep a night for about a week. And then I would crash really, really hard afterwards, and I would need 16 hours of sleep a day. So it's just like it's bouncing from one extreme to the other. It's bouncing from being really, really up to being really, really down. And you become just kind of exhausted from going between those two extremes. I went to New Orleans with my family to visit my sister while she was going to Tulane. And I got so drunk in the middle of the night that my father had to come find me. Like, my father had to come, like, find me somewhere. And I was so blacked out that he must have, like, caught my arm or something when I was stumbling. And he left behind, like, fingerprint bruises from catching my arm when I was, like, falling or something. But I couldn't remember it very clearly.
What visuals do you remember from that night, if anything?
I found a dead cat on the side of the road and sat holding a dead cat and crying for what felt like probably 14 years, but was probably only like 4 minutes. And then I eventually wrapped it in a bag and threw it away.
I imagine you don't really remember being picked up by your father. How was it like to kind of realize what had happened the next time you got up, the next time you looked around?
You get sort of used to being embarrassed as an alcoholic. So you're like, oh, I did something embarrassing again. Like, after the first time you black out, you know, that's really embarrassing. But, you know, like the third time you black out, you're an old hat at that. You're like, oh, looks like I lost consciousness but kept moving and did something stupid. And it's easy to make excuses in your brain like, well, that wasn't me. That was the alcohol. I was just drinking. But then after a while, you sometimes have to recognize a pattern of, every time I drink, I black out and do something terrible. Maybe I shouldn't drink. But it just takes a wake-up call to not make that excuse anymore and to see how addicted you are.
How did you come across Papa and You?
It had been briefly mentioned on a Feminist Frequency video update.
The 2012 indie title Papo and Yo is an example of a game that respectfully deals with the very serious issue of alcoholism.
And I thought that the art looked just beautiful, like the graffiti style art. And I was like, oh, I want to check this out. I heard it was thoughtful and that it dealt with a really painful subject in a really thoughtful way. And I was like, oh, this will be really, really cool. It's a platformer, too. I love platformers. Those are my favorite. And then I got to the end. It was such a sucker punch for me because I wasn't expecting the ending. And I was like, no.
So, for those who've never tried the game, what's Papo and Yo?
It's a fairly simple platform about a Brazilian boy named Cuico who tries to help a hulking red monster.
Monster follows Cuico around, and Cuico tries to push him towards a shaman, using frogs, which seem to make the monster really angry.
But it's the only thing that monster seems to want.
Did you have any idea what the kind of crux, the thematic crux of that game was before you got your hands on it?
I knew that it was going to be about alcoholism a little bit, but I didn't really expect to identify so closely with Monster. There was this part where I was messing up a puzzle and suddenly Monster woke up from being asleep and reached in and pulled me out before I got like smashed by a moving wall. And sort of like there's this part where you can mess up these puzzles, and if you mess up one of them, Monster will just kind of like wake up and randomly save you and pull you out of this hole and kind of like tut-tut you and shake his finger at you and then just immediately like lumber off and go back to sleep again. And I love that part because it shows so clearly to me that Monster's not like completely heartless and unfeeling. Like clearly Monster like cares about Cuico and doesn't want Cuico to be hurt. It's just that sometimes when you drink, it sort of feels like you're an entirely different person. There's like some people have very abrupt personality changes when they drink. I'm one of those people.
In that final moment where it pulls back the curtain and shows that Monster is this father and Cuico has to let him go, what ran through your head?
Well, at the very start of that scene, Cuico is feeding liquor bottles to Monster, and Monster is losing control, and the background is catching more and more on fire. The more liquor bottles you feed him. And as I was watching that, I was like, oh, that is absolutely me. I have zero control when it comes to alcohol. Like, if it's in front of me, I'm just like Monster. I'm not interested in coconuts anymore. I'm like, oh, there's frogs. That's what I want. I don't know. It's hard to explain. Watching those final moments, I was, of course, like, I connected so much with Kiko that I was, you know, obviously very moved emotionally just by Kiko's story. But I also immediately had these, like, kind of nagging thoughts, like, what if I'm a monster? What if when I've been drunk, I've said, like, irrevocably just cruel, cruel things that have made people cut me out of their lives? Because I get really, really, really mean when I've been drinking, like, to the point where I say things that are really abusive and unforgivable. I lost a longtime friend once because I blamed him for my addictive tendencies. I was like, you're being such a jerk that when I drink, I can't even remember what I said, but it was something along the lines of, you're such a jerk that that's the reason I drink, or like something like that. And I was basically like excusing my alcoholism by saying that it was because of the way he was behaving. And he was finally just like, I'm done. I was like, I don't care. And then I really did care quite a bit.
What did it take in the end for you to quit drinking?
Just Papa O'Neill, honestly. I've been drinking for 12 years. And at that point, I was going into a large change in my life anyway, where I had started medication for my bipolar disorder. And the game was so affecting at the start of my medication that I tried drinking. I fell off the wagon a couple times. But since I played it, since I got to the ending just stuck so hard in my head that I haven't drank. Like, I've been able to quit.
What is the process like? What was the process like for you for after having that moment of revelation?
I started talking with my doctor first about quitting drinking, which it's always a good idea to double check with your doctor if you're quitting drinking, because you don't know if you're so addicted that you might be giving yourself like serious health problems by quitting cold turkey. There's also 24-hour helplines, which I absolutely used a couple times when I really, really felt like I wanted a drink, but I just needed somebody else to remind me. Like, I knew I didn't really want to drink, but I needed somebody else to remind me that I didn't really want to drink. Like, because I did really want to drink. Like, I've been running a Kickstarter, and there are some days where it gets very, very, very stressful. It's very high stress, and there are days where I absolutely want to drink. But I find that just calling one of these 24-hour lines, I can talk to a counselor and they can remind me, you don't really want to drink. And just a simple reminder sometimes, I can be like, oh yeah, because if I drink, the world catches on fire, right? I turn into Monster, right? I forgot.
Have you ever revisited Papo and Yo?
I just started replaying it, which is funny. It's my second time through, actually. I didn't need to play it through again, and now I'm playing it through again, and I'm getting the hats, and I worried that that would make it feel cheaper somehow. I was like, oh no, now I'm going to take this beautiful experience, and I'm going to try to revisit it while gathering hats. But it doesn't cheapen it at all. It just opens up some new platforming puzzles, really. And I love that. So I love that they managed to sort of stick in this little like collectible thing without it becoming something that at all cheapens the experience.
I'd like to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Kiva Smith Pearson is a cartoonist. You can follow her work on mostlypretty.tumblr.com.
We got the idea for this segment from one of her Scar comics, which we'll have a link to in our show notes.
That's all for this week. I'm producer Armin Igbali.
And I'm features editor Daniel Rosen. Built to Play was made with the help of
David Walensky,
Tom Seven,
and
Kiva Smith Pearson.
We're available on Stitcher Radio and iTunes. Leave us a review so we know how we're doing and more people can find the show.
We're usually on the air to Scope Arson at 1 p.m. with a new episode on Mondays.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter, that's @BuiltToPlay, or on our website, builttoplay.ca.
Or like our Facebook page, there's a very handsome GIF of Titus laughing on it.
Plus, it's the start of a new theme. We're analyzing the relationship between games and cinema.
This week, check out the site for a review of Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor 2 that explores video games' relationship to anime.
You can follow me personally at Flarkon, that's F-R-K-C-O-N.
And I'm @Daniel_Rosen. Thank you so much for listening.